Hello, this is the first in a short series of podcasts produced on innovative research methods in criminology, produced by the University of Hull, made possible by Research England's Enhancing Research Culture Fund. I'm Ian Brennan from the University of Hull, and today I'm joined by Professor Fiona Brookman from the University of South Wales and Professor Heath Copes from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. The topic of today's podcast is photoethnography, and I'd like to specifically focus on an article that Heath and Fiona have written in the journal Criminology that was published in 2021 using photoethnography. But before that, Fiona and Heath, for listeners who might not be familiar with ethnographic research, could you give us a quick summary of what ethnographic research is?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for inviting us today to talk about this. So ethnographic research is really seen to be very much kind of grounded in a commitment to the first-hand experience and exploration of whoever it is you're studying, whatever particular social group, and a kind of an effort to really capture the reality of their lives and their existence. It's particularly useful because it enables the researcher to become immersed in the kind of the formal or the informal activities of the community. Observation and participation tend to be core features of this kind of approach, but in many cases fieldwork also includes other research methods such as interviews, conversations and the analysis of documents. Almost always that data, once it's collected, are converted into text for the purposes of presentation and publication.
Thank you. Heath, is there anything you want to add?
Ethnography. It really has its roots in anthropology and sociology, and we're coming more from the sociological perspective. And often in ethnography, the researchers embed themselves with the participants. They go and live among the group. And we did not do that. We engage in what some people call appointment ethnography. So instead of living with them, we would just call them up or text them and say, hey, can we come visit today? Or we would just kind of pop up at people's houses. So we just want to make it clear that kind of what we did is not a true ethnography in the sense where we went and lived with the people, but we spent roughly 18 months with them kind of hanging out in their homes, in restaurants and parks, and just kind of more on an appointment basis.
So when some people hear ethnography, they may think, almost a researcher going undercover, assuming an identity or trying to integrate themselves as closely as possible into a community. Is that the reality, or is it something a bit more separate?
We're not going undercover for sure. Everyone knows why we're there. Everyone knows who we are. We are completely open about what we're doing. There's no deception. So if anybody new came, we always introduced ourselves, tell them what we're doing, who we are, and then they could decide if they wanted to continue hanging out with us or they would just come back later. So, yeah, definitely no deception on our part.
And I think the history of anthropology as well, there's been some examples, haven't there, of people who have been a bit deceptive about some of the real reasons they've been there, but they've not normally been completely undercover, I don't think, in many instances.
So Fiona, you said that this typically takes a written form, which nicely allows us to segue into the topic of today, which is photoethnography and the use of photography in research outputs and during the research process. Could you both say something a little bit more about how you use photography in your research?
Yes, so the project started around 2015, thought it was time to do something new. And I had some contacts in this rural area of Alabama who used meth. And I thought this might be an interesting project to kind of start a photoethnography. I had not used the method at that time. I'm very interested in street photography and documentary photography, not as a photographer, but just as a viewer. And I thought this would be a very interesting method to take on. I had read some work by Eamon Carabine and some other visual criminologists, and it really inspired me to do this. So I bought a camera, but as I said, I'm not a photographer, so I was trying to learn how to use it. And someone told me I should go talk to Jared Ragland. J- Jared Ragland, was working at UAB, University of Alabama at Birmingham at the time. He was a former photo editor at the White House under Bush and Obama. And really, the first time I met him, I was hoping he'd just give me some tips on how to take photos. And clearly, I asked him some very amateurish questions. And he finally said, "Hey, would it be okay if I come along?" And I said, "Let's do it." And so we kind of went out there together with the idea that I would kind of learn how to take photographs and Jared would kind of teach me along the way. But eventually we realized Jared's the professional and we just let him take all the photographs. And it started kind of our overriding philosophy when we started was we wanted to act as a counter narrative to kind of the cultural narrative of what meth use and people use meth are like, at least in the United States. And so here, that kind of larger narrative of what people use meth are like typically come from these anti-meth campaigns, the Faces of Meth, the Meth Project. And what these campaigns do is they show these very graphic images of people on meth and kind of creates this idea that everyone who uses meth has bad teeth, sores in their skin, really thin, kind of paranoid and chaotic. And so we wanted to kind of show the complexity in the people. And that was kind of the overarching philosophy when we started. And when we started, the plan was to use more of a documentary photography approach where Jared would take photographs in a kind of photojournalistic style. But eventually we realized we needed to change that up. And we then began kind of incorporating photographs given to us by the participants.
This beautiful, this lovely the first line of the article, cultural narratives about illegal drug use typically portray those who use them as being solely consumed by the drug. And I thought it was just a really nice setup for the images that you use later on in the article. We can come back to that later on. So just in terms of the scope of photoethnography in general within social sciences and criminology specifically, is it a commonly used method? I know you mentioned Eamon Carbine's work, but is it a common technique?
It is not common in criminology. It's pretty rare to use it in criminology. Realistically, criminology, especially in the U.S., is very quantitative. So less than 10% of all articles published in the mainstream criminology journals use qualitative methods at all. And so when you kind of take that 10%, it's an even smaller percent that are using ethnographic methods, and then it's really small when we look at using photographs. Now, when we talk about visual criminology, we have kind of different camps, and so the cultural criminologists have kind of taken over the concept of visual criminology. And while they use images, they're usually not producing images through photography. Some do, but typically they're analyzing pre-existing images. So to kind of incorporate photographs taken by researchers or participants and use them as either illustrations or as tools for data collection is rare in criminology.
Fiona, would you say that's the same in UK and European criminology? Or I know our proportions of qualitative and quantitative are quite different. But would you say with regard to ethnography and photoethnography, it's still relatively obscure?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, as you say, you're absolutely right. We tend to have more of a tradition. We've kind of retained that tradition of qualitative research a bit more here in the UK and in parts of Europe. Interestingly, that was developed so brilliantly by the Chicago criminologists and then seemed to sort of be abandoned in criminology for such a long time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think Heath is exactly right. That's not to say, of course, that images haven't been used in criminology for a long time, because they have. You know, we've got Lombroso with his photographs of born criminals and other deviants. But as Heath says, it's about actually using them in the particular way that Heath did with Jared in this project that is particularly new. And ethnography in general is still, even though people don't go and live like the anthropologists did, it's still a huge drain on your time and resources, and getting access to, you know, not just deviant groups, of course, to criminal justice professionals, which is another kind of ethnography that I've been involved in. That kind of access is very, very difficult to get for sustained periods of time, which is why people don't tend to do it often or for very long at all. So, yeah, it's still rare, and using photographs is definitely still very niche, I think.
It's interesting you mentioned Lombroso, because it's almost feels like what your article does is almost the reverse of Lombrosian. It's trying to break down that stereotype or almost normalize an othered group in your method, as opposed to what Lombroso was doing. But it seems to have come full circle almost. It's interesting. Okay, I'd like to just move to use your article in criminology. Sex, drugs and coercive control, gender narratives of methamphetamine use, relationships and violence, that Heath and Fiona published with Jared Ragland and Blake Beaton in Criminology in 2021. We'll link to this article in the show notes. So I'd like to just use this as a vehicle to sort of think about the process, or talk about the process of photoethnography, right from the conception through to the practicalities of data collection, of approvals and data collection and publication. So I suppose if we follow this process in a chronological way, Heath, you've already mentioned that this is a project that was, sounds like six years in development. Could you talk us through just the process of selecting the topic and taking on this method?
So the topic came about because it was time for me to start a new project. I had some contacts who were using meth, and in this small community, or county in North Alabama. It's an area that about maybe in 2010, there was a documentary by A&E Entertainment, and they called it Meth Mountain. And so it has historically been an area where there's been lots of meth. And so because of the context I had there, we started. So that's kind of why we chose this location. And then, like I said, I was just kind of inspired by some of the work that the visual criminologists were doing, and I wanted to incorporate photography in some way. And that's when Jared Ragland came aboard. And so when we started with the initial contact, and she was living in public housing in this area, which, because she was known in the area and people trusted her, and we were friends, so she trusted me, it gave us this early access. So a lot of the initial interviews were in her house. And then that allowed people to come to us, meet us, see what we were like, see that we're not police, that we were trustworthy. And that kind of slowly snowballed. So we started with Anna as our recruiter. We met people in this public housing. They started introducing us to their friends, and then we kind of spread out through the entire county. So that was the initial process of recruitment. So with the photography, the way we did this at the beginning was Jared was going to use the principles and ethics of photojournalism. And so we would always ask permission if we can take photos. And this was an ongoing consent. So it wasn't like if they said, yes, you can take my photos, Jared took the photo every time we met. Every time we met, we would ask again, because we realized sometimes you're just not in the mood to have your photo taken. So on some days you're okay, other days not. So we would always have that consent. and then, you know, once we kind of started with basic portraits, where Jared would do portraits, and that allowed people to get more comfortable with the camera. So although we interviewed over 50 people, there was really a core group that we were really with in their homes regularly. And for those people, it became just you know, Jared would just take photographs throughout the day as we're just kind of engaging with their life. The idea, again, was to kind of provide that counter narrative, to show the complexity, to show the similarities between their lives and our lives. But what happened was we presented the work at a conference, and Jared was the presenter, and we focused on one woman we call Misty, and we kind of told her story. And the reaction from the crowd was not favorable. And one person said that she felt like we were unsympathetic to our participant. Another said it felt like Jerry Springer. And, you know, in the moment, it hurt me, because I thought, well, this is not my experience at all. Like, I really like these people. And I know that if Misty was in the room at the time and they were attacking us, I would have to stop Misty from attacking this person. Like, you know, Misty invited us to her children's birthday parties and wanted to go out and have drinks with my wife. Like, and so to hear people kind of say that we were unsympathetic to her made us really, after we got over the initial kind of resistance to that, and we thought, okay, well, what's happening? Why are we not conveying what we hope to convey? And, you know, when we just kind of stepped back, looked at the photos, and we realized, without the proper context, some of these photos, they're not countering stereotypes. Right? Some of the photos, if just left on their own, could reinforce these stereotypes of people who use meth. And so we realized, okay, we need to do something different. So when we present, when we write, we need to fully contextualize what's happening with our own perspective, but also with the perspective of the participants. And at this point in the project, all the photographs are coming through the lens of Jared, right? So we are portraying participants through his camera. And we thought, well, what if we also give the participants the opportunity to portray themselves? And that's when we started incorporating photographs and images that they gave us. So we started asking them, all right, send us a photo, a self-portrait that represents you, that represents your struggles with using meth. And so some of them started to send us photographs, and then that allowed us to kind of see things through their perspective, not just ours. And it gave them some autonomy and agency in the research. And so once we did that, we then also started incorporating the photographs that Jared took and the photographs that the participants sent in the interviews, and what we call photo elicitation interviews. So there we show them a series of photographs, either, you know, from Jared and the ones they gave us, and use those as prompts to kind of get them talking about issues that were relevant. Why would they send these certain photos? And so I think once we kind of heard those criticisms, adjusted by using the photo elicitation interviews and providing more context and getting the images from the participants, it kind of helped us better contextualize and present a more empathetic approach. And so kind of our goal when we write is we want to be empathetic to the participants, but we don't want to romanticize them either. I think that's the danger of ethnography, is that you really get to know these people, you get to like these people, and then when you write about them, you don't want to say bad stuff, because in a way they're your friends. And so the struggle we have is, well, how do we tell a true story that doesn't overly romanticize them, but then is also real and shows the harm that they do cause? And that's what we try to strive for. I hope that's what we do. And then, you know, one of the things that I try to do as well is when we complete the manuscripts, I send it to a few of them. and allow them to kind of read it. And is it true to their experiences? Did we get something wrong? Did we kind of portray something in ways that they don't see it that way? And then we kind of adjust accordingly.
Fantastic. Let's just talk about, can we just go take it back to the initial reactions from the audience, which is fascinating, almost a gatekeeping response. Do you see where they were coming from, or do you think maybe they took an overly protective perspective on this? What's your thinking back now?
Yeah, I understand where they're coming from. Again, like honestly, there's an initial hesitance and resistance where I want to fight back. But when I sat back and kind of processed, okay, what is happening? Why do they feel this way? I get it. I understand. We have a legacy, especially with photography in the southern U.S., of taking photos of poor people and what some people call poverty porn, where we kind of just highlight, oh, look at the strangeness of these people. And this is very common in the American South, that people would take these kinds of photos. And so there's a layer of protection of these people. And I think that is important. But then also, we don't want to be too paternalistic. I think some of their criticisms treat the participants like they are unable to consent on their own. Like they don't have the ability to understand and consent. And I think that's problematic as well. And so, yeah, I get the concern, and that's why we adjusted. And we try to provide more context, bring in the participant's perspective, and kind of tell a fuller story.
Let's jump forward, but keeping in that vein, to think about IRB and ethical approval. Could you tell us a little bit about that process? I presume IRBs don't see a lot of photo ethnographies, so it must have been an interesting process to get it approved.
So we have ethical approval from my university in Alabama. UAB, my university, has a medical school, so the vast majority of all the research that comes through the ethics board is medical research. And so throughout my 20 years at UAB, every time I do a project, even if it's just simple interviews with people who offend or people who use drugs, they often call me in. And what I've learned is they're calling me in not because they're trying to block me or prevent me from doing the research. It's that this board really wants to understand the research. They understand medical research. They don't understand this type of research. So by bringing me in, it's out of curiosity. It's to simply make sure that they understand what's happening and that we're treating people ethically. And so because I had this long relationship with them, I kind of believe, at least my ethics board here at UAB, truly wants to understand the research, protect participants, and not just be a bureaucratic agency to protect the university. So because of that relationship, and I've done so many projects, I went to them before I submitted my protocol. And I sat down and said, here's what I want to do. And after they got over the initial shock, we were able to work through some things, kind of talk about what issues will they have, how will we account for that. And then I went and wrote the IRB protocol, submitted it, and then it was kind of a process where we kind of went back and forth when they were unsure about things. How are we going to protect photos? How are we going to get consent? Do we have them sign media releases? What about children? Can we take photographs of children if the parents give us permission and those kinds of things? And we kind of worked through that process. And yeah, they were great. We made the argument that these people have the ability to make decisions for themselves. And as long as we are completely open about what we're doing, where these photographs may appear, that the participants can make an informed decision. And that's what informed consent is about, informing them of the full potential risks and rewards. and letting them make a decision.
I think that's a constant challenge in ethic, and in ethics is giving the participant the agency and acknowledging that they can make these decisions, but also understanding vulnerabilities, and balancing the two of them can be really quite difficult.
So some of the practical things we did was, when we would first meet someone, we would go over the consent form, here's what we're doing, and then we would say, all right, we also have a photographic component. And this is where Jared would come in and explain what we're doing, what the photos were going to be like, and where the photos may appear. And then if the participant said no, we never asked again. It was a one-time question. And if they said, nah, I'm not really interested, we said, okay, put the camera away, and went on. And that was to reduce any kind of coercion through excessive prodding. You know, we recognize that sometimes you can just ask several times and people just give in. And so to avoid any of that, it was a one-time question. They said yes, we said okay. If they said no, we put the camera away and never asked it. And then we also gave them the opportunity that, you know, if they consented and Jared took photos, but later kind of said, you know what, I don't want those photos used, we respected that. Which is interesting, because in photojournalism, their ethics, once someone signs a media release and agrees and you take photos, they can use the photos, right? So even if the participant comes 2 days, 3 days, a week later and says, hey, I don't want you to use those photos, photojournalists can say, no, you've already agreed, we've done it, you've signed the forms. So that was kind of a negotiation Jared and I had of like, all right, let's not do that. And it only happened, I think, twice where someone came later and was just like, oh, please don't use my photos. And so we didn't.
Was there any people who initially said no, and then later, as they saw the project developing and, you know, lived in the same areas, people that were actively engaging that said, oh, I'd like to take part now?
You know, there may have been a couple, but usually the ones who, like, didn't want their photos just didn't want their photos. And then also, again, we had this ongoing consent. So just because they said yes once, doesn't mean that Jared could just show up anytime and just take photos. It was every new occasion, Jared would ask permission.
Did you find that there was a relationship between, or a correlation, I suppose, with how willing people were to have their photos taken with how much they engage with the project overall?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think this is one of the benefits for me of using this photographic method, is that for the people who agree and you're taking their photos, it kind of creates a bond. It's kind of like they're letting you in. And it's kind of an intimate moment between the photographer and them. And so it kind of breaks down these barriers. And so once they've already agreed to take the photos, it's kind of like that rapport has been established and there's a trust. And yeah, those are the people who are the kind of best participants, in the sense that they invited us over more and we interacted with them more. Now, was it the photographs that led to that, or was it just their personalities that led us to do the photograph? I don't know. That it's kind of it's a balance. But I do think there's a point where you can't really separate the data collection from the photographs. They're kind of so intertwined that those who really let us take photographs were very open and just really shared their lives with us.
Did you find that, presumably the process of having someone in your home taking photographs of you must be somewhat unusual at the start. Did you find that people's behavior changed as they became more comfortable and more experienced to being photographed, or was there always resistance?
You know, I personally, when someone takes my photograph, I feel super awkward. And I'm not good in front of a camera. But Jared is really talented, and he's so natural at it that he has an ability to put people at ease. So at times you don't even realize he's taking photographs. And so he just kind of blends in with the photography. And so I think just his skill at being in the field and taking photographs, really, it wasn't disruptive. You know, when I tried to take photographs, actually I was visiting Fiona in Wales, and I met some homeless drug users in Cardiff. And I was like, oh, I'm going to practice my photojournalism. And I had such a hard time being behind the camera. Like, I didn't want to linger too long because I thought it'd be disruptive. So it's a skill that not everyone can do. And so I'm grateful that I had Jared, who had that ability to kind of just blend in, be natural, not disrupt people's interactions.
Just a final question on ethics. So presumably, if you're going to publish somebody's image, there's an anonymity that is broken there. Yet you use the initials of the participants in the article. So there's presumably a balance in terms of the balance that you try to strike there between anonymity and not being anonymous. Could you just talk, how did the IRB feel about that anonymity question, and what was the process of deciding to use those images rather than blur, like, cause presumably you could have blurred those faces, although there were a couple of images.
No, we cannot blur faces because that violates the photojournalistic ethic. So for the photojournalists, documentary photographers, you cannot disrupt any scene. You can't change the scene. It's to the point where Jared would sometimes fuss at me after the fact because I would leave my recorder in the view and he can't move the recorder, or the consent forms would be in view. And he's just like, you ruined the shot here. So like, you can't move anything. So even if like, you can't even move a Coke bottle out of the way to get a better shot. So you can't edit the photos, blur out faces, do these kinds of things for Jared's photographs. So to stick with his ethics, we couldn't do that. So what we tried, you know, we always assign aliases, and typically we let participants choose aliases. And, you know, some feminist methodologists believe that we should always allow the participants to choose their alias, as it's empowering. I don't really know how empowering choosing an alias is. But I still think it's a good idea. Sometimes it's meaningful. So one of our major participants went by Alice, and she chose Alice for a whole Alice in Wonderland theme. And it kind of, she used that theme throughout the project of her going down the rabbit hole and kind of coming out. And so we allow them to pick aliases and for, you know, reasons of anonymity. But of course, once you have their photograph, if you know that person, the alias doesn't matter, right? And so this is where we had to fully explain the reach of the photographs to the participants. And what we did was say, these are going to show up likely in academic outlets, conferences, presentations, academic articles. That's going to be the primary location. So not a lot of people will see it, mainly academics. But if things go well and, you know, Time, we actually, Forbes did an article, Vanity Fair, Italia did an article. Now we're kind of hitting broader audiences. And so it's possible that these could show up on the websites of kind of major outlets. And if that happens, well, you know, it's going to be a lot more attention brought to it. So we wanted to, that's rare, but it's possible. So we just kind of explained the full range of where these photos may appear. and then let them make the decision on their own.
Excellent. Thank you. So presumably, if I recall correctly, data collection was, what, 18 months?
Yeah, it's roughly 18 months. It's kind of hard to say because when does an ethnography end? I don't know. Because the way I contacted them was primarily on Facebook Messenger. And so even when I said, okay, I'm not collecting data anymore, sometimes they still send me messages and send me photos. And so the project kind of lingers longer than you think. At one point, I even thought, okay, I'm going to literally show up, go to their houses and say, this is it. I'm not coming back anymore. It's over. And that still didn't work. They still would send that. So it kind of, it's hard to say when it really ended. But it was roughly 18 months.
So presumably, and Jared was involved throughout. So presumably, or I assume so, presumably you've hundreds, thousands of photographs. So when it comes to publishing, you have to choose just a select few. What's the process? And this is as a team, I suppose, of four authors. What's the process for selecting images between you? And then I suppose also, not illustrating is the wrong word, but adding a verbal narrative to those images. How did you as a team, how did you work together to select those images and write about them?
So we used images in the final project in two ways. So some of the manuscripts we produced, the photographs are more illustrative of kind of these ideas that we're talking about. And then in other cases, the photos were the ones used in the photo elicitation interviews. And so there it's a more direct link to the data. And so we kind of use them in both ways. So typically if we're using them in the more descriptive way, Jared does the selects. He begins with, here's the photographs that he believes kind of meet a certain level of quality for a kind of fine art perspective quality. That kind of differs from the way I and Fiona want to use the photographs. We want to use the photographs more in a way of what kind of elicits responses. Right? So there's this one photograph of Alice that technically is a bad photograph. Jared hates it. For me, it's a wonderful photograph because what it is it's a very blurry picture of Alice. But when I showed her the picture, she says, oh, yeah, this is what it was like at the time. I was blurry. I didn't know if anybody cared about me. Did I care about myself? So it really allowed her to kind of symbolically talk about what was going on. And so we kind of like, we have to straddle the fine art quality versus the, does it reflect the concept that's being used? And so it kind of depends on the outlet. If we're going fine art outlet, Jared does it all, right? There's a particular, there has to be a balance and a rhythm and a flow to the photographs, and he chooses. When we talk about the manuscripts, then it's kind of the researchers here, Fiona and I, kind of come in and kind of look at the photographs that kind of a large select, not all of the photographs, that kind of fit the ideas that are happening or the ones that were literally used in the photo elicitation. And then we kind of strike a balance there between fine art versus what's kind of reflecting the idea of the manuscript.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, you know, one of the things we were obviously always thinking about was the reader, you know, the person that was going to view this that didn't know anything about the project and what images really best help to illustrate the particular concepts that we were exploring? I mean, this particular paper obviously was about coercion and control, and so there's particular images that very clearly demonstrate that in ways that other images might not have. So that was always something that we chatted about, and sometimes we'd get it down to two or three, and then sometimes it's just literally a matter of preference that one image just somehow speaks to one person more than another, but we try to think about the audience and what they would take from the images.
In particular, I really like the photograph of the toilet as the sanctuary for using meth away from our family. It's a really very simple image, but it's beautiful in terms of what it illustrates. We haven't talked about the content of the paper very much, but one of the components to this is a sort of narrative, longitudinal component about meth use, but sort of changing relationships and gender. Naturally, photographs are cross-sectional. They're an image in time. How did you balance, or is there a way in which you can sort of balance that longitudinal narrative that you're trying to create with cross-sectional photographs?
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Sometimes what we found, so we have another paper with Misty where we show kind of her trajectory in her relationship with her current ex-husband at the time, husband. And so we have early photographs in the beginning of the project, in the middle, and at the end. And so as I would do follow-up interviews with Misty, I could show her some of the early photographs. And the same with Alice. You know, we show them these kind of earlier photographs, and they can talk about, I remember what it was like back then. Look how much I've physically changed. And it kind of brings them back. So, yeah, that photograph was taken at a specific point, but by looking at it 6 months, a year later, it allows them kind of revisit, well, where was I mentally at that time, literally physically at the time, what did I look like? I remember there was one time that Alice sent kind of matching photographs, so some that was at the very beginning of the project and some at the end, just to show how much she physically changed. So when we first met Alice, she was in, you know, the high point of her meth use, and she was very thin. As she got healthier and was getting off meth, she kind of put on more weight and she just looked healthier. And so she like made the little, you know, side by side photos for us. So I think what the photos allow us to do is kind of go back in time and kind of, it makes it easier to talk about those events in the past because now there's an actual prompt. I can look at that, go back to that moment. So the blurry photo of Alice, we used that several months later. And so at the time, she was very emotional. And she kind of, we had agreed to meet, but she didn't respond once we got there. And just right as we were leaving, she finally said, okay, I'll meet, here's where I am. And it's because she relapsed and she didn't really want us to know that she relapsed. So in the moment, there was no way we could collect data, right? It was just not the right time. She was not in the mental state. But we can have that photograph come back months later and it can bring her back to the time. Okay, well, what were you thinking here? And that allowed her to kind of get into the blurriness of her thoughts. Did anybody care? Did she care?
And that's one of the advantages. Sorry, Heath.
Yeah, please.
I was just going to say, I mean, that is one of the really key advantages of using photos in this kind of research is that sometimes things are too difficult to talk about when they're happening to you. But if you've got the distance of time, everybody can, you know, it's easier then to reflect upon what was happening. And that's something that you wouldn't really get with other research methods. So I think it's one of the, I know we're going to talk about maybe towards the end, the kind of the strengths and limitations as a whole, but yeah, that's a really important one in my mind.
Yeah, it's you can imagine it's just so much easier to use that stimulus than say, cast your mind back So the more stimuli, the better to bring you back to that time, the more eliciting it is. Okay. So just in terms of selecting the images as well, are you looking for example, an even balance so for example, in this article is about gender. So were you looking for an even balance of not necessarily just men and women, but good and bad, bad relationships, good relationships? Is there some sort of balance you're trying to strike, or is it largely driven by the narrative that the authors have given you?
For this one, it was primarily driven by the story that we're telling. But we also wanted to be sensitive to include photos not just from Jared, but also from the participants. So that was the kind of primary concern of like, okay, how do we incorporate enough photos from each group, from Jared and from participants? That was more so than, you know, a certain number of women, certain number of men. It was really more about, well, what's the story? What photos fit the story? And how can we kind of use both types of photographs?
Okay, so moving on to the outlet in which this photoethnography was published. So I know that as a team, you've both written together about photoethnography in journals like Deviant Behavior. This particular article is published in Criminology, which is the quintessential mainstream criminology journal. It's arguably the flagship journal for our discipline. And by that nature, it tends to be perhaps less adventurous in the methods that it's used. Well, I'm not sure if you agree with me or not, but if I'm not mistaken, this is the first photoethnography that Criminology, the journal, has published. So could you tell me a little bit about the process of breaking ground on use of this method in mainstream journal like this?
Do you want to go, Fiona? You want me to go?
You can take that, I think.
So our approach was, we're not going to self-limit ourselves, right? So instead of deciding, oh, criminology won't take a photoethnography, so let's not even bother, we're going to send it to the best outlets we can, and then make them tell us no instead of telling ourselves no. And so it went surprisingly well. There was really no concern or criticism or resistance to the photos. The review process was all substantive, theoretical. They really helped us flesh out the coercive control. The only thing they mentioned about the photographs from any of the reviewers or the editors was one of the photographs in the initial version had a photo of a child, and they didn't want to put a child in there. So even though we had permission from the parents, we said, okay, I mean, that's a reasonable request. So surprisingly, of all the articles we've published with photographs, I think only one time has a reviewer mentioned photographs. Yeah, it's been surprisingly easy.
I don't know what that says about the discipline. I mean, perhaps they are just excited by some of these new methods now, and so that's not something that they focus upon. If they can see that the photographs are being used in a way that's generally helping to advance knowledge about the particular issue that's being discussed. And of course, there is still an image of a child in there. He just has a mask on.
He has a mask. Yeah. Yeah, and the one reviewer, this was not for criminology, this was for another article I submitted. This reviewer said that they were uncomfortable with this line of research and thought it was voyeuristic. And when our rebuttal was, we disagree. And for that paper, all the photographs were those submitted by participants. And so we did not use any of Jared's photos in this one. And so we just argued there's nothing voyeuristic about it, and there's nothing sensational about the photos. and eventually they accepted it. So that was the only one kind of criticism of having photos was one reviewer. And I think we're up to, I think I published 11 or so papers using photographs. So it's been surprisingly, people have been receptive, at least editors and reviewers, and nice things on Twitter.
I mean, I think it does make a difference, obviously, if you've got an editor who, you know, knows something of the work already, which was the case in criminology. I think that was potentially mm-hmm. helpful. And it probably gave us the confidence to go for that journal a little bit as well, because, as you say, it is considered by many criminologists as kind of the top notch, you know, journal. And lots of people might shy away from it. But I think, you know, I certainly felt that it was the paper was a good enough quality. But I think it gave us that extra confidence knowing that somebody was at least going to be, you know, receptive to the idea of the paper in the first instance. You know, I mean, there's so many people now that just get desk rejects, don't they? You know, your paper gets rejected at the deadline, which is just a horrible process, obviously. So I think we thought that we'd get past that at least.
Do you, as a team, so you have a sort of reputation for using photoethnography now, do you feel that that helps overcome some of those boundaries? I know it's anonymous, but in the reality is maybe it's not so anonymous if you have a niche. I don't know if you have any insight into whether that helps or is what I'm getting at, I suppose, is if I was a novice researcher who didn't have an identity or well known for a particular area, what should I do if I wanted to use these methods?
I think you'd have to convince the people that were going to be receiving that paper that the photos were there for a really good reason, that you weren't just using photos because it was, you know, some new kind of idea or different idea. I think they've got to add to whatever the substantive arguments are or points are that you're making in the paper, as well as obviously all the sensitive ethical and methodological issues that you'd have to discuss. I think that would be an important issue. Imagine if I was reviewing a paper, that's what I'd be thinking.
Things that criminology, the editor and reviewers had us do was really expand on the methods. So our method section is really long, longer than typical, because they wanted a full discussion of what is photo elicitation? What are the ethics of using photographs? Why are we using photographs? How do the photographs inform the data? And so we really spent a lot of time kind of articulating that. And I think we're probably still at an early enough stage in criminology that we still need to do that. So we can't just automatically assume all our readers are always already okay with photographs and the ethics of it. I think we're still at a point where we have to fully articulate this. And I think that'll help.
When I was reading the paper, I felt the sense that sort of it almost felt defensive, and yeah. you're just imagining reviewer number two like reading it and just sort of thinking of all the sort of potential criticisms. And I was going to ask, was this defensive writing from the start? Not defensive is probably the wrong phrase, but was that planned from the start, or was it in response to reviewer two saying, you know, we need more on this?
It was a bit of both. I mean, we'd already had quite a comprehensive method section, as I recall, because we're both very interested in that. But yeah, it certainly grew and developed as we had to respond to the reviewers' comments and concerns. Yeah, I mean, positionality, for example, we hadn't said a lot about that at all. And then we added that in, didn't we? Actually, interestingly, I don't think that was in response to a reviewer. That was that we had just suddenly thought, well, actually, we should probably say something about this, because given that, you know, it was Heath that collected the data with Jared and I was at such a distance from it and I've never even visited that area. You know, when I was reading through the data and seeing the photographs, I was asking different things of it and thinking differently about some of it. And we decided that actually that was a benefit, not a limitation.
I definitely think that was one of the strengths of having kind of a... Jared and I are so tied to it that sometimes it's hard for us to kind of see things because we're so connected. And so by having Fiona, an outsider, look at things can kind of help us really see what's happening in a different light and kind of question what's happening, make us kind of rethink our ideas. So I think it was, you know, a great collaboration to have kind of people from different perspectives looking at the data.
That leads me nicely into what advice you might have for somebody who's interested in using photoethnography. So, for example, you worked with a professional photographer and researcher. So you built a team with sort of different types of expertise. Do you think that's necessary, or can someone learn this skill alongside being a criminologist? Or what advice would you have for somebody who wants to sort of develop a project like this, or develop a project like this?
I think it's possible to be a photographer and researcher together. I just didn't have those skills. I'm very happy that I worked with Jared. I think having the two of us in the field together really helped for many reasons. One reason is it's very stressful. You know, when you spend 18 months with people who use meth, it causes a lot of anxiety. It caused me a lot of anxiety. And having a research partner who's there as well. Kind of get some of this out, relieve some of that stress. But then also, I think it's good because Jared is coming from such a different perspective that his insights, you know, as a photographer, he has insights into human nature that as a sociologist, I might not have. And so having both of us there kind of really allowed us to kind of come from different perspectives and kind of see what's happening from different viewpoints. And so I liked working with Jared. I mean, I think it's, there's a lot of strength to having a team doing these kinds of things. But is it necessary? No, of course not. I think if you have that skill set, then yeah, you know, you can go at it on your own. I think, you know, if you start this kind of project, recognize that it's if you're doing an ethnography, there's a lot you need to be aware of. Ethnographies are hard. They can wear on you. They're emotional. And so be prepared for that. But even if you're doing photo elicitation, I think photo elicitation is a great method, and I would encourage more people to use it. But it's also difficult because essentially, if you're asking participants to give you photographs, you're giving them homework. And no one wants to do homework. And so I'm currently doing a project with people who use peyote in religious ceremonies. And this group of people is so happy that I'm there. They love that a researcher is there and is going to, you know, kind of share their story about how much they've grown spiritually, mentally by using these psychedelics. And when I talk to them, they're like, oh, yes, I want to take part of it. But they still don't send the photographs because it's work, right? You know, now you've sent them off to do this chore. And so be prepared that even people who are really committed to the project, they might not all send you photographs. So you kind of have to figure out that balance of how much do you push them to send photographs versus, you know, I don't want to annoy them either. So there's some difficulty in there. Practically, how do you get the photographs? How do you store the photographs? How do you create what we call a photo kit? You know, and that's where you, like, what photos do you select to use in the interview? All of these things you kind of have to think about beforehand.
I mean, is it worth mentioning that Jared's photographs were always black and white, weren't they, Heath? So that's obviously a stylistic approach that he preferred. And they're mostly always going to be printed in black and white anyway, of course. But that's an interesting issue, isn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, it gets back to that idea of representing people. And by there's kind of symbolic meaning to having color photographs versus black and white. And what does that kind of bring to the viewer? how are they going to perceive this group based on simply whether or not it's black and white or color. So these are kind of issues you have to think about and have a kind of a philosophy on beforehand.
I would just add that, you know, ethnography is ethically challenging anyway, isn't it? In a sense, what you did was a collaborative ethnography. And there's also very, very little written about collaborating in ethnography. I've just written a chapter now. It wasn't that kind of ethnography. It was following, you know, homicides from crime scene to court as the detectives and the scientists investigated them. But doing it with somebody else comes with some great benefits, but can also be challenging as well. So I think there's going to be some interesting things to write about that on top of the use of the photographs and the fact that you had a professional photographer. And of course, it has to be planned so carefully in advance, because it's much more difficult to work out what you're going to do with the photographs, how long you're keeping them for. And I know we were chatting the other day, Heath, about whether some of the photographs that have already been published can be used again now in this conversation article that we're going to be doing. So I don't know whether that's something worth mentioning, that how often you can use those photographs in repeated publications.
It's an issue that I don't know much about. I don't know what the guidelines rule, because it's, at least in criminology, it's such a rare method. So you kind of have to think about how often can you reuse a photograph. Is it okay to publish the same photograph in multiple journal articles, even if it's getting at different ideas?
Yeah.
Is that from a plagiarism perspective, what would your reservations about that be?
I don't know. So the issue that we're talking about now is the conversation has asked us to write an article using Jared's photos, but they want to find a publishing partner. And they think that the publishing partner may not want to publish photographs that have already been published in media outlets.
So it's almost a copywriting issue.
Yeah.
Or I think it seems to be more of like we want to be the first ones to present these images. We don't want to use leftover images or previously used images. We want to be the first.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's probably worth telling you what happened in that conversation piece, which would have been published by now, but for the fact that when they saw the photos, they absolutely loved them. So what happened was, it started out as it was just going to be a fairly small standard piece, like all the conversation articles are, about the paper that we're talking about today. And then they saw the photographs, absolutely loved them, and they said, we think we can do one of our bigger pieces on this that's much more focused on the photographs. So now we're kind of thinking things through, particularly with Jared, about other photographs and how it might work. And that's when this issue arose. But it just struck me as it was an interesting problem to have, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Can you use your photos again, and which ones? And yeah, who wants to be the ones that publishes those neat ones first and all the rest of that? So
I suppose, final question, that are outlets like The Conversation, because they're entirely web-based, allow you to use not just photography, but you could use more longitudinal or methods like video. What do you see there being potential for that in the future?
Yeah, definitely. So right now, when we publish in print journals, we're kind of limited to the number of photographs we can use. And they're almost always in black and white, even if they were originally taken in color. Now, some journals will allow you to publish in color, but the author pays for that expense, and it can be very expensive. So it kind of limits the style of photograph and the number of photographs. But for these online journals, for instance, the Journal of Qualitative Criminology and Criminal Justice is an online journal, which then opens the possibilities up. Right? Now we can publish more photographs in black and white or in color, and we can embed video. And I think this can really open things up for publishing visual criminology. So we have one article in this journal, the Qualitative Crime Journal, where we have a 1-minute video And it's just 1 minute video of a guy we call JC. And then we attach an essay that kind of links what he's talking about to kind of ideas of masculinity and unemployment and identity. And so by being online, it gave us that potential. No other print journal could have published this article.
I see huge potential for that for the future, and not just in ethnography, but I think any sort of any methodological approach could actually benefit from sort of video support. It's one of the sort of one of the futures of scientific publishing is the platform that we use, because it really can add serious value to the reader's experience and what they take away from it.
Absolutely. And even there's ways that you could depict part of your method section in a paper through video, isn't there, and audio, that I think would be really, really beneficial, particularly to people who are new to that method. You know, you could be talking through some of the issues. You could be showing what happens, in debates about some of these methodological issues. So, yeah, I think it's the future.
Just to wrap up, so any other advice for a sort of novice researcher in criminology might think about photoethnography? Where do they start? Any advice?
I kind of go with you just do it, right? Don't get too much in your head. Don't over kind of complicate things by finding problems, find those solutions. And if you want to use photographs, then do it. Find, be thoughtful and mindful of the ethics and the practical aspects. But I think there's a strength in photography and in images, that these images evoke emotions and they can help not only the researcher, but the participants and the viewers, right? So for viewers, I think criminology, at least in the US, is becoming increasingly detached from our subject matter, right? I think we can find that a large number of American criminologists have probably never spoken to someone who's committed serious crime. And that kind of shows itself in the articles. And so even qualitative research in some way is detached from the participants, right? Because we are getting their stories, but we abstract them. And so what we write about is not really specific people, but the bigger ideas. Photographs don't really allow you to be detached, right? They pull the reader back in to the people. And so I think it's important and valuable to have photographs for that reason. But then also for the participants, I think it can be helpful and therapeutic for the participants.
And
my example of this, my example of this is I re-interviewed Misty probably like a year after our first interview with her. And at this point she had stopped using meth and she had separated from her abusive husband. And so I was like, oh, well, what led to this? And she said that because she was so involved with helping us find people and looking at the photographs, she started kind of seeing her world through kind of our eyes, through an outsider, through the photographs. And she said, it just looked ugly. And she said, is that what I look like? And so it made her kind of rethink what she was doing and how she was living her life. And that was one of the reasons, probably not the only reason or the most important reason, but it was a reason that kind of pushed her to stop using meth and separate from her husband. In a way, it can be therapeutic for the participants to kind of think about their lives and find photographs that represent their lives that can help them process, but then also just seeing what they look like from an outsider perspective. Now, I don't want to oversell this because, obviously not all of our participants were that self-reflective and changed their behavior. And this only came about because, we had a relationship with Misty. It wasn't like a one time we did photos and never saw her again. But I think for some, it can be therapeutic and beneficial.
I was just going to add as well that I think that, you know, in terms of the discipline of criminology and any social science discipline, one of the things that photographs helps to do is to show people in their multidimensional ways, so that which is really helpful for challenging that distance between the researcher and the researched. And, you know, so master identities that get ascribed to particular groups of people, like crackhead or dope fiend or, you know, whatever it might be, whether they're deviants, criminals, or in fact criminal justice actors, you know, I think you can help to show the complexities and the shades of grey through this process in a way that's possibly much more difficult to do just with the text. So I think that's a really important way that you can help to advance theory potentially as well.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Fiona, Heath, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for taking the time today. As a first episode, I think it's been really good, and the big challenge will actually be editing it down to a manageable size. But it's been a really wonderful experience, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.